A group of experts and scholars have concluded that senior government officials have covered up crucial facts about what really happened on 9/11. They've joined in others in common cause as members of Scholars for 9/11 Truth because they are convinced, based on their research, that the administration has been deceiving the nation about critical events in New York and Washington, D.C. These experts suggest that these events may have been orchestrated by elements to manipulate us into supporting policies at home and abroad. Some of the inconsistencies even have to do with Flight 93. That was the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. Did it crash naturally by the fighting that was occurring in the cockpit? Was it shot down? Will we ever know? I have a clip that is pretty emotional. I'm going to play it for you. It runs 4 minutes. If you don't think you can take it, I suggest that you go away for 4 minutes. I was listening to it with one of our engineers tonight, Bill Hickey. And he says, it's got to be one of the most emotional things I've ever heard. Here it is.
Morning, Cleveland, United 93, is with your 350, intermittent light stop. United 93, checking in, 350.
United 93, 350, roger.
United 93, that traffic to you is 1 o'clock, 12 miles eastbound, 370.
Negative contact, we're looking, United 93.
Somebody call Cleveland.
United 93, verify 350.
United 93, verify your flight level 350.
United 93, verify your level of 350.
United 93, Cleveland.
United 93, Cleveland.
United 93, if you hear Cleveland Center, identify, please.
United 1523, did you hear your company, some interference on the frequency here a couple of minutes ago, screaming?
Yes, I did, 797, and we couldn't tell what it was either.
Okay. United 93, Cleveland, if you hear the sound right then.
American 1060, ditto on the other transmission.
American 1060, you heard that also?
Yes, sir, twice.
Roger, we heard that also, thanks. I just wanted to confirm it wasn't some interference.
Was that 956?
Rejected 956, go.
Oh, we're just answering your call. We did hear that yelling, too.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, we're just trying to figure out what's going on. Calling Cleveland Center, you're unreadable. Say again slowly.
Sir, did you hear the transmission? Was that your plane that said he had a bomb on board?
Say again. Was that United 93?
Yeah, that transmission he said was unreasonable. It sounded like someone said they have a bomb on board.
That's what we thought. We didn't get it clear. United 93 calling. Executive 956, that aircraft we believe was transmitting is 12 o'clock, 5 miles. Turn left, heading 225. I'll get you away from him. Okay, he's climbing, so I want to keep everybody away from him.
Okay, I think we got him in sight.
So the 1989, that traffic for you is at 11 o'clock and 15 miles southbound. 41 climbing. Looks like he's turning east while heading 360.
Hi, he's a captain. I would like to order the main team. We are on the board and are going to make the airport.
United 93 calling. United 93, understand, have a bomb on board. Go ahead. Executive 956, did you understand that transmission?
Affirmative, he said there was a bomb on board.
And that was all you got out of it also?
Affirmative.
93, go ahead.
That aircraft, he can't get a hold of. Has he turned to the east now?
He's just turned to the east also. United 93, you hear Cleveland Center. American 1060 and Executive 956, we just lost the target on that aircraft.
Okay, 956, we had a visual on him, just stand by.
Do you have a visual on him now?
We did, but we lost him at the turn.
You can make a turn back to a 220 heading, let me know if you can see him.
Yeah, he's still there, we got him for 956.
He's still there, northwest of you, about 25 miles?
Affirmative for 956.
Executive 956, heading 180.
Hey, we're making a turn for 956, he appears to be heading right towards us.
American 1060, do you see anybody northwest of you? Can you shoot back that farther?
We're looking now, sir.
United 93, Cleveland, do you still hear the center? United 93, do you still hear Cleveland? United 93, United 903, do you hear Cleveland? United 93, United 93, Cleveland. United 93, United 93, do you hear Cleveland Center?
Do you see any activity on your right side, smoke or anything like that?
about probably 2 o'clock. It appears to be just a dark cloud, like a puff of black smoke.
So all of us who have flown planes can only imagine what was going on in that plane on that fateful day. In a moment, James Fetzer, who will stay with us throughout the entire program tonight, and also David Ray Griffin, he will be our guest this hour as well. Stand by on Coast to Coast AM. James Fetzer is Distinguished McKnight University Professor of Philosophy at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. He is a former Marine Corps officer, author, editor of more than 20 books, founder and chairperson of the S911T. That's the organization we're talking about, Scholars for 9/11 Truth. James, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Oh, George, great to be back with you. Please call me Jim.
Oh, you got that right. And also David Ray Griffin is the Emeritus Professor of Philosophy of Religion and Theology at the Claremont School of Theology in Claremont Graduate University, author, editor of some 30 books, including The New Pearl Harbor and the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. David, I'm glad you're able to come back and join us. How are you?
I'm fine, George. Good to be back with you.
Likewise. Likewise, indeed. What I'd like to do, Jim, and also David, is give both of you just a moment to make a brief opening remark of why you were so compelled to come forward again with this information. You, Jim, why you are part of Scholars for the 9/11 Truth, and then David, of course, get a statement from you as well, and then we'll get into our discussion this hour. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, George, once you look at the evidence, it becomes apparent that the only problem with the official account the government has provided of the events of 9/11 is that it's just fine if you're willing to believe impossible things. Laws of nature cannot be violated and cannot be changed. They include, for example, the melting point of steel, the highest temperature at which kerosene-based jet fuel can burn, the rate at which masses move in free fall versus masses moving in the path of resistance, the temperatures of molten metal found 3, 4, 5 weeks afterwards in the sub-basement levels of the World Trade Center, the kind of damage that would have been inflicted on the Pentagon if it had been hit by a Boeing 757, the behavior of the government in retrospect, the events of the Flight 93 you were describing. I had residents of the area calling me to explain that they told the FBI they heard explosions in the air, but the FBI wouldn't write them down. I had residents of the area write letters to me and tell me that they were taken to an area way outside of the officially designated crash site, and that the deputy sheriff said that while they were bringing them out to look for aircraft wreckage and human debris, that if they told anyone, the sheriffs would deny it. I have a friend who was a former inspector general for the Air Force who used to investigate air crashes, who told me that if that plane had crashed the way it was officially described, its debris should have been distributed over approximately one square block. In fact, it's distributed over 8 square miles. We have reports, in fact, the plane even may have landed in Cleveland, that a Boeing 767 out of Boston made an emergency landing in Cleveland Hopkins International Airport, that the mayor reported it was supposed to have a bomb aboard. We have multiple reports that cell phone calls are not possible from these aircraft at the altitudes and speeds they were flying. The whole thing appears to have been a sham, George, a sham. The American government appears to be manipulating the American people on the basis of acts of violence and threats of violence in order to instill fear into the population to manipulate them for political purposes. It all appears to be corrupt. And if those of us who have special abilities and expertise to analyze these situations and to explain them, don't explain them to the American people, then I'm afraid the population has no way to know what's actually going on here.
All right, and James will be with us for the entire program tonight, and we'll be taking your phone calls in the last hour with Jim Fetzer. David Ray Griffin, why don't you give us your overview of this situation?
Well, presupposing everything that Jim just said, when I first got into this, I was motivated primarily simply by the question of truth. That is, it seemed like the official story was not true. for all the kinds of reasons Jim gave, although it took me a while to work myself into those. But more and more, I've seen how much everything this administration is doing that most of us are opposed to, including the attack on Afghanistan and Iraq, the Patriot Act, the dismissal of the environmental problems of the world in favor of seeking empire. All of these things are justified by 9/11. We keep hearing that anybody who objects to the administration is thinking in pre-9/11 terms. And so these wiretaps, everything is justified by 9/11. And this administration has done so many things. One could rattle off a dozen things that should have brought impeachment, should have brought an uproar, but nothing has thus far brought them down. And I've thought for some time it might only be the truth about 9/11. That's the one truth the American people and the Congress would not stand for. And so I've been motivated in large part more recently by those considerations.
You know, it was strange timing, David Ray Griffin and Jim Fetzer, with the situation with the United Arab Emirates company in the ports, because though I can't say they're related with what we're doing, at the same time, it does create the confusion. And the big issue here is the lack of information. And that, I think, is one of the biggest problems that Congress has now over the UAE port situation. And that's the fact that it seemed to have been done in a cloak of secrecy. And with what you've been talking about tonight and what we're going to get into, it seems like it's the same kind of secrecy.
Well, everything is secrecy with this administration, George. If you go back to that energy task force that I think was plotting out the foreign policy of the United States, we're not even allowed to know what it is. This is a problem parallel to the CIA. When the CIA operates in secrecy, implementing a foreign policy of which the American people are completely unaware, how can we know whether we even approve of the foreign policy of the United States? It appears to be one of oil acquisition abroad, that we have gone into Iraq to control their oil. The oil, I bet you, is being pumped out. It's not even being metered. And we're hearing reports about an attempt to take the sliver of Iran that controls 90% of the Iranian oil. This is all quite disgusting, and it appears to be largely predicated on the desire of Iraq and Iran and Syria and possibly Venezuela, too, to go to petro-euros rather than petro-dollars, which means that whereas in the past the American dollar was related to a gold standard or later a silver standard, now it's related to a oil standard. If the dollar is decoupled from oil as a unit of measurement or purchase, then it's going to be basically in free fall. I think that the rich friends of George W. Bush are desperate to ensure that that doesn't happen, and that the true motivation for what's going on in the world has a great deal to do with trying to preserve accumulated wealth and very little to do with actual threats from abroad.
Why does it seem to me that people now are at a point where they're just fed up?
Wow. I'll tell you, George, you go back, all the lies this administration has told us from the beginning. I mean, look at what Bush did when he first came into office with those massive tax cuts for the rich. He actually utilized the Enron technique of telescoping profits. What Enron did, what got them into trouble, was they'd have a contract that said in 5 years you'll have a $10 million profit. And they wrote it down on their books as though that $10
million was already there. Yeah.
Yeah. And what was going on? I mean, Clinton had put us on a trajectory for these massive surpluses. It was spectacular. It was stunning that he had accomplished this task. Bush simply treated those projected surpluses as though they were already on hand and claimed that he could cut a trillion off. Do you know, George, that if in fact it weren't for those massive tax cuts, our budget would basically be in balance except for the war, which they're running off the budget anyway?
True.
And then global warming, George, my God, they pulled us out of the Kyoto Accords. The best scientists worldwide all agree that global warming was a threat to the planet. Pulling us out for the sake of short-term profits for companies that consume fossil fuels is putting at jeopardy the entire human species, George, the entire human species. Once you get an interruption in the food chain at any level, all species above that level are destined for extinction. This is happening now. It's the concern is whether we've already reached the point of no return.
And so I assume what everything you've just said, Jim, is somewhat related to this 9/11 situation.
Well, the 9/11 situation all appears to have been born in part out of ideological beliefs that the as the sole superpower in the world, the United States had the ability to project its power and create an empire that would exceed that of any previous dominion over the world, and that there were enough of these neoconservatives, as they called themselves, that actually came into power. They had a document they wrote that spelled out their plan. It's called Project for the New American Century. It was published in 2000. And George, not just Bush himself, though his brother actually was a member of this group, but Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice, and you go down the list, these people came into power with a plan to project American power around the world. And a central element of that plan, George, was to take, occupy the Middle East and use it as a base of power around the world.
All right, let's talk about what happened. Let's get your views, both you, David Ray, yeah, Griffin, and Jim Fetzer. This hour is going to go by quickly. I want to get David's perspective, especially this hour, Jim, in as much as you're with us for the whole program. Let's talk about some of the facts here surrounding 9/11, the inconsistencies, and what both of you feel to be why we didn't get what you believe to be the full story. David Ray Griffin, let's start with you. What do you see as some of the most compelling things that stand out, why you think there's something wrong here?
Well, there are so many. One is the fact that the official story about the World Trade Center just makes no sense at all from the point of view of physics and chemistry. Another is the fact that the story about the attack on the Pentagon also does not fit with the physical facts, that there was not the kind of damage caused that a 757 going several hundred miles an hour would have caused. And eyewitnesses have reported that there was simply not the debris, whether outside the building or inside the building. And then Bush's behavior, or particularly the behavior of his Secret Service that morning. So those are three of the big ones, but there's quite a list.
All right, well, let's talk first and foremost about the buildings coming down, because that seems to be a major issue, and let's talk about the science portion of that, if we can. Part of the argument is Popular Mechanics, by the way, one of the only publications to try to back up the official version of what happened. Steel, we all know, melts at a certain point. It didn't get that hot, did it?
That's absolutely right, George. I mean, the steel melts at about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. The fires, however, could have a maximum temperature of approximately 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit if they had a lot of pure oxygen available. The fact that the dark black smoke was burning from those buildings is indicative that they were oxygen starved and never reached temperatures close to 1,800, which would still be 1,000 degrees below the melting point.
Okay, could the steel, David Ray or Jim, could the steel have weakened because of the heat?
Well, that's the official theory, and one of the few things that article in Popular Mechanics got right is that it's a red herring to be talking about the idea of melting, because even though a few of the early stories and TV shows suggested the steel melted, the official theory has always been, no, that it weakened the steel sufficiently that through some process or another. I mean, there are different theories. The 9/11 commission presupposed one kind of theory. The more recent report by NIST gave another theory.
Hold on to that thought, David. We'll come right back to that when we return on Coast to Coast AM. Couple more days to take advantage of the predictions.tv website. You can watch the program right there on your computer. That's www.predictions.tv. Or if you want a DVD and you can keep it forever, well, you can order it that way too. Predictions.tv. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Jim Fetzer, David Ray Griffin, our guests this hour. David, let's go back to you, talk about the structure, if we can. If we can assume that in the history of engineering, a steel frame high-rise never collapsed because of a fire, how could we have three happen in one day?
Well, that's right. The odds against that happening would probably be about one in a trillion. So that's one big problem. The other big problem with the official story is that even if you say that it didn't, you know, the steel didn't melt, but it just weakened, the collapses would not have occurred, even if they had been possible, in the way they occurred. For example, if steel softened, it would start to bend and sag. And yet, as you see from the video clips, all three buildings have a sudden beginning. There's a very sudden onset to the collapse. Then the collapse is straight down rather than the buildings falling over. They fall at virtually free fall speed.
Well, could that have been because of the weight from each layer of the building?
Well, that's the official theory. But one problem of that is the next characteristic is that these were total collapses. So the 110-story Twin Towers collapsed into a pile of rubble only a few stories high. Building 7, which, of course, was not hit by a plane and did not have significant fires in it, collapsed in the way of a classic implosion into a very tiny pile of rubble.
And that's the one where the owner was overheard of saying, you know, we brought it down or something like that?
Well, Silverstein, the owner and the one who had taken out a lease on the whole World Trade Center just a few weeks before it had been finalized.
And he had a $3-something billion insurance policy on the lease. Is that true, Jim Fetzer?
3.5. Absolutely right, George. And Underwriters Laboratory, by the way, just to complement what David has been saying, had certified the steel used in these buildings for 2,000 degrees up to 6 hours before it would show any significant weakening. Well, most of that fuel burned off in those gigantic fireballs we all saw when the buildings were first impacted by the aircraft.
Somebody had told me, Jim and David, that they cut corners in the World Trade Center and provided inferior steel. Can you buy that argument?
No, I think that's nonsense. These were admirably constructed buildings. In fact, they had marvelous load redistribution properties. Frank DeMartini, for example, who is the project manager, explained how they could withstand multiple impacts from the largest commercial airliners then available, which were Boeing 707s. The 767s are very similar in their size, mass, and other dimensions. He said that the effect of one of these aircraft hitting one of these buildings would be like sticking a pencil through mosquito netting. So neither the impact of the planes nor the fires, which, by the way, burned only very briefly. Remember, if they're certified for 6 hours up to 2,000 degrees before they even show significant weakening, the South Tower fell in less than an hour.
True.
And the North Tower in only about an hour and a half. So there simply wasn't enough time for that steel to be heated and to melt. In fact, steel is an excellent conductor, George, which means that if you heat one part of it, it rapidly dissipates to other parts, so that in order for the government's theory to be remotely plausible, you'd have to be simultaneously weakening or melting the whole floor. And remember, those buildings were designed to withhold those structures. They were very solid. There were 47 massive columns that went up the center of those buildings and another 240 around their perimeters. They were some of the best built structures in engineering history.
Well, I've got to tell you, in St. Louis, where I hail from, there's a company there called Spiritus Wrecking, and one of their major functions in life is to bring down buildings. And so I've seen a lot of video of their work, And I do have to tell you, on that morning of 9/11, when I saw those buildings go down, it looked exactly like a demolition.
Well, that's very good, George. In fact, you know, David mentioned how Larry Silverstein told this fire chief or whoever that he thought there'd been so much death and destruction, maybe the best thing to do was to pull it, and that then they watched, the firemen made the decision, then they watched it come down.
All right. If they did pull Building 7, maybe that was the right thing to do. So why is that a big issue?
Well, because we're talking about 5:20 in the afternoon, about 7 hours after the other events. It wasn't hit by any aircraft. It only had a couple of very modest fires. It was one of the most massively designed buildings in engineering history, from all I can tell. The support beams there were absolutely solid steel, which is highly unusual. It was constructed over a huge electrical generator providing electricity for lower Manhattan. It had a command bunker in there that had its own air and water supply, George. This was a building that just was not going to come down.
So,
and if you stop and think about it, in order to pull it, there had to be pre-positioned explosives.
Okay, it's something you just couldn't do in 7 hours. Then.
Absolutely not.
Like, all right, now, what about the argument that because there was so many, I guess, confidential things in that building, it was pre-wired to go down? Of course, I got to tell you, I wouldn't want to work in a building if I knew it was loaded with explosives.
Well, it's very, very strange, you know, what's going on here. There were all kinds of, I mean, CIA, Secret Service, I mean, the emergency management office there. Giuliani was in there apparently observing all this going down. He said they were warned that the towers were going to collapse, which is quite bizarre by itself since this had never happened before in the history of structural engineering. So who's giving him this warning for this completely unexpected event? The fire teams are in the buildings. They don't have any reason to believe they're going to collapse. They're saying they can easily control these fires with a couple of lines.
Okay, if the buildings were taken down, how did they get the explosives in these buildings? I mean, first of all, the amount of explosives would have had to have been huge.
Well, actually, that's a very interesting question. There were all these security anomalies in the 2 weeks leading up to 9/11, where various parts of these buildings were shut down. The employees were told to go home.
Oh, really?
And they shut off the normal security controls, including the cameras. Stephen Jones has calculated that it would have taken 40 men 10 trips to plant enough explosive to take these buildings down per building. So it's not really that massive project. Plus, they were, you know, people, there were many reports about these teams of so-called engineers going in and out of the buildings, and they claimed that they were replacing cables in the buildings, but it had never happened before.
Okay, what about the two planes that hit the two towers then, in the poor souls that were on those planes?
Well, David, what would you like to know about them, George? I mean, one hit at the 80th floor, right?
I mean,
South Tower.
You're not denying that the planes were hijacked, right?
I'm not denying, no. We're not denying that the four planes were hijacked by 19 alleged Arab hijackers. At least that's the official story,
George.
And let me make it very clear. The official story is extremely interesting for the following obvious reason upon reflection. When you have two or more individuals coordinating their efforts to bring about an illegal end, they are engaged in a conspiracy.
Sure.
So the government's own theory here that these 19 guys under control of a fellow off in a cave in Afghanistan pulled this off is obviously a conspiracy theory. Now, from our analysis of the evidence and so forth, it's a hopelessly untenable one because it's not defensible. But notice how the government tried to resist even having any investigation whatsoever. It's like what Bush is saying now. He wants to look forward regarding Katrina, for example, not analyze what actually happened. I don't see how you can be the security president without analyzing what happened so you know what went wrong so you can make sure it won't happen again.
Okay, I just played a tape of Flight 93, the one that crashed over Pennsylvania. And, of course, as you know, there's a controversy over that plane. But, I mean, I could distinctively hear someone with a foreign accent saying bomb, bomb. Now, I mean, are you saying that didn't happen?
Flight 93?
93, yeah.
Well, 93 actually appears to have been shot down. I mean, remember I was explaining how I was called by residents of the area who told me they heard the explosions in the air. There's not, the debris is scattered over 8 square miles, George. That's inconsistent with the idea that it crashed. as an inspector general for the Air Force confirmed to me that, you know, there's even a report of a Major Rick Gibney, who was with the Happy Hooligans, a famous Air National Guard unit out of Fargo, North Dakota, was transferred over to Langley temporarily, may have shot it down. Now, interestingly, I was on a program the other day with a fellow who actually had made that report, who said now it had turned out to be false, but I didn't get to pursue it. All he means is Gibney today is denying it, but that's very typical.
All right, but if it was shot down because it was hijacked, I you know, sadly enough, don't have a problem with it. I mean, I might have even, if I were running whatever part of government needed to make that call, I don't think we would have had much of a choice, do you?
Sure. Fair enough, George, about 93, but then why does the government lie to us? What, we're not entitled to know what actually happened?
Well, you know, I guess like TWA Flight 800, which I think also went down under very suspicious circumstances, I don't think they want us to know that they had to shoot down a commercial plane. I don't think they want us to know that maybe Ramzi Youssef and his group took down TWA Flight 800 for fear and panic. I don't agree with that. I think we should be disclosed everything.
Well, I think there's a different reason they don't want us to know about TWA 800. All the evidence I have suggests that it was brought down by a missile fired from a submarine during a training exercise, and they sure as hell don't want us to know that, George.
Well, that's possible. I'm going to go on that case with the Peter Lance theory that Ramzi Youssef and his project Bojinko, that, you know, he wanted to do that. He was on trial at the same time. That's another issue. Let's not take away time from this. Okay, well, so let's go back just a little bit. Planes have been hijacked. They're heading for the two towers, all right? Do you believe that there are people in those planes? Some people think they were drones. Nobody was in there.
Do I or does David? I would say David and I think, both believe that there were passengers in those planes.
Okay,
but,
all right.
But George, I mean, the whole account the government has given us violates laws of nature. It's an impossible account. The melting point of steel could not have been reached. The fires weren't hot enough. They didn't burn long enough. They couldn't have even weakened. As David was pointing out, it would have caused an asymmetrical sag. It wouldn't have caused a complete collapse. Look, if I went to the top of the building, say a 110-story building, and released a grand piano, it would reach the ground about the same time those buildings came down. But the grand piano is falling through free space, no resistance whatsoever. It's not physically possible that the building could have fallen at the same rate as that grand piano unless all the resistance had been blown out by the floors beneath it. It's not physically possible.
What about the concrete of the building? Some say that it was all pulverized. That's not supposed to happen in a mere collapse. Is that true?
David can elaborate at length on it, but let me make the point that, in my judgment, this is the smoking gun. You have this huge cloud of debris at the top. Remember, you release that grand piano. You expect it's going to fragment and shatter when it hits the ground.
Sure.
Similarly, for Building 7, okay, it didn't make this huge cloud of dust basically until it hit the ground. But Twin Tower 1 and 2 were the opposite. They're like exploding from the top. You have seen massive debris being blown out horizontally and even upward, George.
True. That's
completely
true.
Physically inconsistent with one floor falling on another.
All right, David, react to that.
Well, I mean, that's right, and it's exactly what you would expect if very powerful explosives were used to slice the steel. And that's the only way you can explain how you had this total collapse when these buildings had these massive steel columns, particularly the core columns, the 47. You would require quite a few slices in the steel. Well, such powerful explosions are going to pulverize the concrete and virtually everything else in the building. People have reported that at Ground Zero, all they saw, for the most part, was steel and dust. They didn't see tables. They didn't see computers. They didn't see much of anything. Everything virtually was pulverized.
George, I'd just like to point out that David earlier, when he offered that estimate of one in a trillion, was being very kind to the government, because the fact is that the effects that were being displayed here cannot have been brought about by the causes the government alleges, so that those effects on the government's official account, that is a combination of the impact of the planes and the fires and the one floor pancaking on another, has actually a probability value less than zero. It can't happen. It's physically impossible. So I introduced the term null, a zero with a bar from it. It's impossible. Can't happen at all.
React, if you can, to what they were saying about the plane that hit the Pentagon. Some people say it wasn't a plane. And I can swear, Jim, I've seen a picture of some plane parts out there in front of the Pentagon.
You've seen a picture that appears to have been planted. There is one piece of a plane that was actually photographed in different locations, George, that appears to have been planted. It doesn't actually fit on any part of a Boeing 757. In other words, you take that and move it around the fuselage, you won't find the place where it fits. What's missing, see, that entry hole is actually very small. Most people see these photographs after the upper floors collapse, but that was about a half an hour after the initial impact. The initial impact hole is only about 10 feet high and maybe 16 feet wide, about the size of the double doors of a mansion. There are unbroken windows in the immediate vicinity. There's fence there that's unbroken. There's all these cable rolls. If a 100-ton Boeing 757 with a wingspan of 125 feet and a tail that stands 44 feet above the ground had impacted there, there would have been massive debris, a huge crater. There would have been remnants of the wings, the seats, the luggage, the fuselage. I mean, you know, the bodies would have been all over the place. The tail, not even the engines were recovered. The only engine part was actually compatible with a much smaller jet. It was too big from a cruise missile and too small for a Boeing 757.
What do you think hit the Pentagon?
Well, it actually happens to fit an A-3 Sky Warrior. It's a JT-8D engine. And there was an independent report that some A-3 Sky Warriors out in near Fort Collins, Colorado, at a small airport, were being retrofitted by teams of engineers, and they were designing them with Global Hawk technology,
really?
Missile technology, all kinds of stuff.
Those are drones, aren't they?
Pardon me?
Those are drones, aren't they?
Well, they can be remotely controlled, absolutely right. I mean, it's pretty tough for a pilot, no matter how conscientious, to deliberately fly himself into a building. The only few frames, you know, that the Pentagon has ever released, and it's stunning because if they wanted to, if you look at that building, there are cameras on that building, you know, every 100 feet or so around the entire perimeter. It's got to be the most heavily defended building in the entire world.
I mean,
these guys get $400 billion a year, you know. They're going to make sure they're secure.
Where's the video?
Cameras across the street. There's one frame where you can actually see what looks like it might be the silhouette of a small plane, and there's a plume that may be a missile fired from it just as it came to impact with the building that would be consistent with the sort of damage incurred. I mean, even the entire the inner structure, George, of the damage to the support pillars is inconsistent with a Boeing 757. Plus, see, either the Boeing came down at an angle, in which case there would have been a huge crater analogous to what you would see for other plane crashes around the world, or it came almost horizontally. But to hit on the ground floor, those engines would have been plowing up the ground or even the fuselage, George. That's why the fact that the lawn is perfectly smooth and green as a putting surface is extremely significant.
I agree with that, Jim. You're absolutely right there. There should have been marks from this plane skidding in. Nobody could have hit that with a direct hit that way.
You got it.
Well, David, we're wrapping up this hour. How quickly it goes. What would you like to say before you say serenara for the night?
I don't know. There's nothing just off the top of my head I want to add.
Other than you're convinced something was seriously wrong and it's not the official version.
Well, yes, and the my second book on 9/11 is called the 9/11 Commission Report: Omissions and Distortions, and it's simply full of stunning omissions, such as the fact that Cheney was already down in the underground shelter by 9:15, certainly by 9:20. Norman Mineta says it, but. The 9/11 Commission says, no, he didn't get down there till almost 10 o'clock, and that's very convenient because then he wasn't there when whatever was hitting the Pentagon was doing that, and he didn't have time to give a shoot-down order for Flight 93. One would think the news media, the mainstream media, would at least point out this rather obvious lie, but of course they don't.
All right, David, we're going to have you back again on another day. When we come back, Jim Fetzer will stick with us along with Morgan Reynolds, Dr. Morgan Reynolds. He used to be the chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor during George W. Bush's first term. We're going to talk with him.